From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Although most of us have been examined using x-rays, CT scans, PET scans, and MRIs, there's still something mysterious and miraculous about these tools of radiology and the ways that they allow physicians to see inside the human body. On today's edition of Please Explain, we'll look into how these tools actually work. And if you've ever wondered about how to understand the difference between a CAT scan and an MRI or PET, now's your chance to ask. We'll be taking your calls in a little while. Joining me are Dr. Robert Zimmerman, Executive Vice Chairman of the Department of Radiology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He's also Director of Diagnostic Imaging at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, Cornell. And Dr. Jonathan Sussman, Clinical Director of Vascular and Interventional Radiology, New York Presbyterian at the Columbia University Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Zimmerman, to start with the most basic question, what is radiology?
Radiology basically encompasses the things you've mentioned. It's all of medical imaging, so it includes techniques that use x-ray, like x-rays of the hand and the chest that are people commonly get. It includes CT scanning, which also uses x-rays. It includes ultrasound examinations, PET and nuclear medicine studies, and of course it includes magnetic resonance imaging. So it's really all the imaging under that uses those technologies.
Although the name kind of suggests radiation, it's not all of these radiology forms employ radiation.
Correct. Ultrasound and MR do not employ radiation. Radiology comes from the fact that obviously the first things that people used in medical imaging were x-rays and radiographs, so that's the name, and some people have talked about changing the name of radiology to medical imaging, but we kind of think radiology is a nice, neat name, and it's fewer letters and one less word, so we like to keep it as radiology.
And you've been saying it for years. Dr. Sussman, the term nuclear medicine has a radioactive sound to it. Is that part of radiology?
Yes, it is. Nuclear medicine employs the use of injecting isotopes into the body to allow for more of a functional imaging. The resolution of the images are not as good as, say, a CAT scan or an MRI, but it allows us to tailor examinations to look for function in the body. And indeed, you're actually injecting a radioactive substance, and the camera picks up that radioactivity under a camera.
Well, aren't you doing that with other other forms of radiology?
In an x-ray, there is radiation, but the x-ray is being shot through the patient towards a film, and the x-ray that's blocked by, say, a bone or even, say, a bullet that someone shot in the emergency room, the shadow is what you see on the x-ray. So the white on an x-ray is actually a shadow.
Go ahead, Dr. Zimmerman.
We do inject medications for CAT scans or for MR scans, but the medications themselves are not radioactive. They alter either the ability of a certain part of the body to absorb x-rays, or they change the way the body responds, different organs respond to the MR scan magnetic field, but they themselves are not radioactive. So in the case of radionuclide studies, including PET scans and traditional nuclear medicine studies, you're injecting a radioactive substance. Whereas with radiology, you're using a high-energy beam that has that's the radiation to make the image. So it's a little different, but both traditional radiology, CT, and nuclear medicine do involve use of high-energy radioactive or high-energy particles.
And you mentioned earlier that Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen discovered the X-ray in the late 1890s, which earned him a Nobel Prize, the first in physics.
You know, I looked that up last night just so I could answer that question. You beat me to it.
Okay, well,
1901, the first Nobel Prize in physics.
But how did he figure it out?
He was actually working with, he and other people were working with high energy sources from cathode ray tubes, and it's sort of said that he inadvertently discovered it because he was blocking visible light and could see some kind of glow. But the reality is that he was working towards an understanding of what these high-energy particles and tubes would do. So he was going to discover X-rays as part of what he was doing. It probably may have taken him a day or two more, or a week or two more, but he was basically exploring what we now know to be the sources of X-rays.
Although in those days, people did not understand the negative aspects of it. I even remember when I was a kid, I used to go to the local Tom McCann store, and they'd put me on something where they showed me the bones of my feet. And now I think about that, you know, unshielded, I think, oh, gee, someday that's going to do me in.
When I was a kid, they would take, you'd go to your doctor's office and he'd fluoroscope you for no reason, just to see your chest move. Things have changed.
It's interesting that Dr. Rentgen very rapidly realized the medical implications of this new particle or X-ray that he discovered. The tube that he was discharging an electrostatic charge was wrapped in cardboard, so it was blocking visible light. And he looked across the room. He had a little screen across the room, and he happened to put his hand in front of it while he was holding a piece of lead. And when he blocked the X-rays going through, he was able to see an image of the bones of his hand across the room. And so it was with very, very great rapidity that Dr. Rentgen and the world realized that there were medical implications to this mysterious X-ray. I think we still call it X-ray because it's so mysterious, because it's invisible. And
but it also understood that lead was a way of blocking out the rays.
Exactly.
Now, is it possible to think of the developments in radiology along a timeline that we're able to easily follow? X-ray, and then what comes next? Nuclear medicine?
Well, nuclear medicine, the first imaging of nuclear medicine was probably in the 50s, but people had begun to use radioactive iodine in the treatment of thyroid disease, and they would kind of try to figure out where the iodine was going. But the first nuclear medicine camera was about 1956, and ultrasound, people began to use ultrasound medically around 1950 or 51. In both Sweden and Japan. They used it in Japan to look for midline structures in the skull. In people with brain tumors, those structures would be displaced. And I think in Scandinavia, they were looking at heart valve function and blood flow. So that was sort of early 50s. CT scanning was introduced in about 1972. It was developed, the first practical CT scanner, or not so practical CT scanner, was built in England by...
Hounsfield,
and he worked for the Electronic Music Incorporated, and whose main claim to fame and to financial success is the Beatles. And those first EMI scanners were in the United States by 73 or 74, and so we've seen a rapid and just consistent improvement in CT technology in terms of how quickly the images can be obtained and their quality since then.
You wanted to add to that, Dr.
Yeah.
Sussman.
Well, I wanted to make sure the audience understands CT scanning and CAT scanning. CT is computed tomography, or CAT is the same thing. It's a computed axial tomography, and essentially it's a computer assembling multiple X-ray images. So it's really just multiple X-ray images that a computer assembles in order to give us sort of 2D and really 3D when you assemble all the slices together. What I wanted to add also is that my particular specialty, which is interventional radiology, has a very interesting timeline in itself. Angiograms or arteriograms and venograms were performed by injecting iodine-based liquid materials into the vessel. So there was a direct puncture via a needle into, say, if you wanted to look at the carotid artery, you could palpate the carotid artery on the neck, put a needle in, and inject contrast into it. And so angiograms were performed, again, the iodine blocking the X-rays going through, and so the vessels would appear, or the lumen of the vessels where the liquid was, would appear white on your X-rays. But then very interesting things happened. In 1953, a Swedish radiologist named Sven Seldinger came up with the Seldinger technique, which was putting a needle into a vessel that had a hollow bore to it and sliding a wire into the vessel, then pulling the needle out and then sliding a catheter in. And then the catheter-based radiology took off. And in 1964, the father of interventional radiology, Dr. Charles Dotter, who was at the University of Oregon, realized that you could do something called dottering a lesion, which was he could take a narrowing in an artery and slide a catheter through that had a narrow tip but dilated along the course of its shaft, and he could dilate a vessel, therefore, thereby restoring flow to an occluded vessel. Balloon angioplasty was in 1977, really started by Dr. Grunzig, who had a catheter, the tip of which had a balloon that could be inflated and deflated, and then coronary angioplasty started from there. And really the whole notion of taking a catheter that you can introduce through a small incision and do things with it. Dr. Dotter called it turning the catheter into a scalpel, opening up arteries that are closed, closing arteries to which you don't want there to be blood flow, say from trauma where someone's bleeding. And that's the whole field of interventional radiology and really the incorporation of the technology of radiology with the performance of surgical minimally invasive techniques.
My guests on today's Please Explain Looking at Radiology are
Dr. Radiology.
Well, I work in radio. Dr. Jonathan Sussman, who is an interventional radiologist. He is clinical director of vascular and interventional radiology at New York Presbyterian at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Robert Zimmerman, executive vice chairman of the Department of Radiology at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, director also of diagnostic imaging at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Zimmerman, how does somebody decide whether an X-ray is necessary or whether it's going to be ultrasound or CT or MRI or PET?
Well, I mean, traditionally, the referring physician would order the study that he or she thought was appropriate, and that still happens to a great extent. But one of the things that radiologists have come to do more and more of is direct clinicians in choosing the appropriate study and then choosing the appropriate follow-up study. We have so much technology, some of which produces, you know, can be overlapping in terms of their efficacy, that radiologists have now come to see their roles, not only in terms of interpreting studies, but in guiding the imaging workup, if you will, of patients. You know, they're always sort of give and take, and there are always benefits and risks. You know, any X-ray study, including a CT scan, has the risks of radiation.
But for example, Dr. Sussman, mm-hmm. will different MRI technicians arrive at different conclusions?
The technicians or the...
Or whoever's reading the MRI.
Well, I'll go back to that in 1 second, but I think the different techniques that we have are good at looking at different problems. And so
if I have a bad back, let's say, and I may have a herniated disc.
So you would get an MRI examination by, if you had a competent physician, would send you first probably for X-rays because they're less expensive. But if you're really looking for disc disease, it would be appropriate to get an MRI.
But if it's a cancer problem?
Well, then...
Suspected?
MRI would still be the test. MRI is the best test we have for... For bone cancer, MRI is the best. If you were concerned, say, about an abdominal cancer, you could do an MR scan, but CAT scanning or CT scanning is probably the procedure most people would do because it's faster and you can get a lot of information from it.
Okay, but so let's back up again, okay. And I throw this out to both of you. What does MRI do that would make it preferable as opposed to a CAT or a PET? What MRI, as I understand, is a magnetic thing. It gets all the cells to kind of line up by applying a powerful magnet. And what do you learn? Is that right?
Well, what it does is the magnet actually works on the protons in your body, and most of us are made of about 95% water, and two-thirds of that water is are hydrogen protons. So MR affects the hydrogen protons. It causes them to kind of line up and spin around an axis, and then so you apply, you put someone in a magnet, they become essentially magnetized to a small amount, and then you apply a radio wave, which is very low energy, and that affects the way those protons move, and you can then read out. Basically, your body then becomes a radio transmitter. You put a radio wave in, and if you're in an MR scanner, your body will, in essence, send back another radio wave, and you can read that radio wave and gain a lot of information about anatomy and pathology. The advantage of MR over CT is that most processes affect the amount of water in tissue, and MR is just intrinsically much more sensitive to the amount of water. So if I change the water content of a tissue by 5%, I'll change its appearance on CT by 5%. But there are MR techniques where the same change in water content will produce a 200% change in either the darkness or the brightness of the image. So, for instance, in the brain, MR is just much more sensitive than CT for detecting really a whole host, in essence, almost any pathology. And it's also radiation-free, so you avoid that. So,
Leonard, to answer your question in a more sort of the tissue that you're looking at dictates the appropriate imaging test. So for, say, bones or looking at the abdomen or looking at the lungs and the chest, a CAT scan is appropriate.
What does the CAT scan do that tells you something that the MRI won't tell you?
Well, the MRI frequently may tell you, but we start with a CAT scan. The CAT scan is much better for bone, looking at the bone itself. Looking at the bone marrow, the MRI is better. Looking at your spine and the discs, the MRI is better. Looking at your brain, the MRI is better. Looking at the bones of the knee, the CT would be better, say, for a fracture. However, for looking at the ligaments in your knee, all of a sudden you started hearing about anterior cruciate ligament tears, and you always hear, it's Super Bowl weekend, you always hear that the guy has twisted his knee and he's going off to get an MRI to figure out what's wrong with his knee. All of a sudden you start hearing about these injuries because the imaging, when MRI came out, the imaging became so much better at looking at ligaments and looking at the cartilage, and all of a sudden all these injuries that we didn't know exactly what was happening, you could now see. So for the brain and the spine and musculoskeletal system and the female pelvis, looking at the uterus, we do a lot of work on women with fibroids who have symptomatic fibroids, and so we order MRIs to look at the fibroids, and if they have symptomatic fibroids that could be treated, we embolize them.
Well, both of you are suggesting to me that MRI is the best one, and yet I know all these people who are winding up taking CAT scans and PET scans.
Well, CAT again, some things CAT scans are much better for, in particular, say, for someone who's got acute trauma. Because MR isn't nearly as good as showing fractures, we do CT scans. They're faster. And
Bob, certainly for the chest, right. Looking at the lung, right. The CT is far superior. Right.
And for instance, for cervical spine injuries, although MR scans will show you if there's something wrong with the spinal cord, it's much more common to injure the bones, and CT is much better for that. So in trauma, the first line is almost always CT, with MR used only to clarify issues that aren't clear on the CT scan. PET scanning is a nuclear medicine test that whose major advantage is, as I said earlier, is you can get information about metabolic states and physiology. So it's very good for detecting recurrent cancer in people who have been treated for, say, lymphoma or other cancers or head and neck cancers. It's useful in other for looking at physiology in the brain, and it's been shown to have some value in Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia. PET scanning is intrinsically not a very precise anatomic procedure. There's just not enough information about the underlying normal anatomy. And so one of the recent advances is to actually have an MR, a PET scanner and a CT scanner in the same piece of equipment. So you get an anatomic image, and you get a PET image, and you can then fuse them together to have a single image which has information about anatomy and information about physiology or metabolism. And the CT scan also helps to make the PET images more reliable.
To give an example of when PET CT fusion images would be helpful, in patients that are being treated for cancer where a mass has shrunk, but it's still there, and you see it on the CAT scan, But in order to know whether it's active or not, whether it's metabolically active, is there still cancer cells there, or is it just scar tissue that's remaining after successful chemotherapy? By doing a PET scan, what PET does, you inject a radio-labeled glucose, FDG, fluorodeoxyglucose, and it goes to areas of metabolism. So what frequently would happen is, say, a patient got screened with a PET with a PET scan initially that was active where their tumor was, and now they get their follow-up imaging, and that area is now cold. There's no metabolic activity there. So it's a scar, and we can...
But if we see metabolic activity, then we know that this is a growing cancer.
That could be still, likely it's going to be still active cancer.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Dr. Robert Zimmerman and Dr. Jonathan Sussman. We're talking about radiology. We're back with Please Explain with Drs. Jonathan Sussman and Robert Zimmerman, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's get right to those calls. Eve from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm scheduled to have next week a bilateral breast MRI as a follow-up to mammogram and doctor exam, and my concern is, I guess what I should say is I believe you have, the patient has to lie prone, face down, with arms extended. I have a shoulder problem, and I was wondering if the doctors could think of any way that there could be an adjustment so my arms would not have to be straight out.
Are there MRIs that are more limited? You don't have to put your whole body in there, Dr. Sussman?
I have to be honest with you. I don't know exactly how patients are positioned for their breast MRIs. However, I do a lot of procedures that take long periods of time with patients who have their arms raised over their head, and we take great care in moving the arm over the head very slowly, and I tell the listener that when she's done with her examination, which shouldn't be that long, when she brings her arms back, to do it slowly, because her shoulder will tend to cramp if she does it quickly. The other thing is that you can take an anti-inflammatory beforehand, which may make it easier for you, particularly if you have, say, arthritis or another problem with your shoulder.
Dr. Zimmerman, you want to add anything to that?
There are MR scanners that are said to be open, where you're not put in a tube. But for breast MR, you really need to have a high field strength scanner. So most people are able to tolerate these exams even when they're uncomfortable in them. You need to have the technologist help you do this, and the physician. But in particular, when it comes to things like breast imaging, in most places, the people who are going to be doing the imaging are very well aware of some of the problems that patients can have. So, you know, it's not possible for me to say whether you'll be able to tolerate it or not, but I'm sure that the people who are trying to do the exam will work with you in a way that will produce the best possible results.
A lot of people who've been through MRIs wonder why they make so much noise.
Well, actually, it's interesting because people think there's something moving in the MR scanner. It's not. It's actually the electronic circuits that are switching off on and off at very high speeds that create those noises. So there are no moving parts, but when you do an MR scanner, you have a very powerful radio frequency generator, and it's that thing in combination with different parts of the electronics of the magnet that make it go on and off. And some of us can actually tell what kind of MR sequence is being produced just by listening to the noise. And I've been in MR scanners a fair amount. Whenever they want to test something, they put me in, and it does get noisy, but sooner or later you can tolerate it. And we give patients earphones or earplugs to try to mitigate against the noise. But the better the MR scanner, the more powerful and the more complex the imaging technique that's used, the more noise it will produce.
Ken from Manhattan, hi, you're on Please Explain.
Yeah, hello. I think the MRI, the noise, I think it's a blast, by the way, but I have a question.
Whatever turns you on.
It does have, you know, do have some interesting rhythms.
No, it's great. I think this is for Dr. Sussman. I've been told I have a pretty bad case of tendonitis. I've been told that there's a technique involving ultrasound and the use of a needle to break up the tendon, which can then heal again. Does this ring any bells?
These are the trigger points, and so it's part of rehabilitation and pain medicine where they're trying to place a needle into a muscle or a structure that's in spasm, and you can use ultrasound to locate that structure. And very often, the treating physician will simply use feel to figure out what areas are tight, but you can use ultrasound to look at structures of the musculoskeletal system, and use ultrasound to guide the needle into a specific location. It's really a kind of image guided intervention, and that's one of the other things that's new in radiology, and maybe Jonathan can speak to this a little more. Yeah. But we now use images to guide lots of minimally invasive and non-invasive percutaneous techniques for treating diseases. You can deliver chemotherapeutic agents to mass lesions. You can even use MR for a technique called focused ultrasound, where a focused ultrasound beam is placed in a specific organ to use to treat uterine fibroids, and is now maybe for prostate cancer. And use an MR scan to localize the area, but you use the focused ultrasound to treat it.
Ultrasound is a important tool for us in interventional radiology in guiding needles and catheters to various areas where patients would need therapy. One of the things that I do a lot of at New York Presbyterian is radiofrequency ablation. Radiofrequency ablation is the elimination of tumors by application of heat. So say a patient has a tumor in their liver, under ultrasound guidance, I could guide a needle into the tumor, deploy little wires out of the needle, and attach it to a power supply, using radio frequency energy, deposit a tremendous amount of heat within the tumor to kill the tumor. And we could treat tumors up to 7 centimeters in diameter and completely eliminate them using radio frequency ablation. And all we've done is guide in a needle that is less than 2 millimeters in diameter under ultrasound guidance. So ultrasound can allow us to get to almost anywhere in the body.
We go now to Joe from Long Island. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi there, Leonard. I've actually had a few PET CT scans over the past year for initially staging Hodgkin's disease. I'm just actually curious about the process itself. The CT portion of the test goes fairly quick, but the PET portion actually seems like at least an hour or two to go from, do the whole body scan. And I was just wondering if that was a reason, because of the technology itself, or, how come it takes so long to do when you compare it to a CT portion?
Well, I would think it's because it takes a while for the medication that's been injected to produce enough positrons to be registered by the scanner. A CT scan, CT scans are basically incredibly fast now, but the PET scanning, it still takes time because it's really not the sensitivity of the tool. It's how you just have to wait for the agent to be distributed to the body to the appropriate areas, and then you have to have time to measure the counts or the radioactivity that comes out of the body.
What's important is to look at the relative accumulation of the metabolic agents in your body. So the camera has to watch for quite some time so that it gets enough counts to image the area of interest.
Evan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes. This is Evan from Queens. I just wonder about the economics of it. In my experience with insurance companies, MRIs are rather a top expense, and sometimes I wonder if we're not given MRIs when actually they should be indicated because of the high cost. Is that a problem?
It is a problem. The cost of all these tests is high. for the most part, insurance pays a certain amount, and virtually all centers who deal with insurance companies accept those amounts. So the charge that may be listed is actually not the amount we get, but the cost of all this technology is a serious issue for the entire society, because there's no question that these exams are expensive, but there's also no question that when appropriately utilized, they're extremely valuable. So that's an issue that really the society, you know, we in radiology have to address it, of course, but the society has to address it.
But it is a lot more expensive here. You can get a CT scan in Europe for a minimal amount. I don't know about MRIs, but I did once get a CT. And here, everything seems to be so incredibly expensive. I realize these machines are very expensive, but over time, don't they amortize themselves out?
Well, they do, but the life cycle for, given the rate of technological improvement, after about 3 or 4 years, if you want to stay current, if you want something that's really going to be better, you're going to have to replace or at least upgrade the scanner. Again, the price of the scans that you see is not the actual amount that either the hospital or the imaging center collects. That's pretty much determined by negotiations with third party payers. But it's true that the examinations are more expensive here than in Europe. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that in Europe most of the care is is under
government subsidized.
So I don't know that that's a reflection of the true cost. And, cost is a complicated issue.
Dr. Sussman?
I do think that physicians try to order the least expensive test first as sort of screening measures. Say someone has a problem with their abdomen, you start with an ultrasound. If there's a problem that needs more delineation, perhaps you go to a CAT scan. And if that doesn't answer the question, then maybe to an MRI. Leonard was saying earlier that MRI seems to be the best test, but it's really quite expensive. So generally, we start with the least expensive and then move from there.
Betty from Brooklyn, hi. I think you're our last.
Yes, thank you. Clarification, I thought I heard one of the physicians say that they do not use radioactive tracers on MRI, and I had that done recently. I have MS, and I was told that is now the gold standard, and I just want to know if I didn't hear correctly or...
The contrast agent that we use for MR and that we use in patients with MS is not radioactive. It's something called, it's a rare earth called gadolinium, and it's tied to a large molecule, but it in and of itself is not radioactive.
Now, Dr. Sussman, are there certain things certain of these tests that you can't take on a regular basis? Do you have to wait months or longer in some instances?
We have inpatients that need these scans quite frequently, so I think it's sort of a cumulative dose over a lifetime. But the amount of radiation that a patient gets from these tests is so low that I don't really think you have to worry about that.
Okay, I'm going to sneak another call in here. Royal from Williamsburg, you have to make it very quick.
Hi. First question was on healthcare reimbursement rates, which you sort of touched on. Second question quickly is if you're familiar with proton radiation therapy and what the benefits are of that compared to more traditional.
Well, neither one of us are radiotherapists. Proton beam is something that's used in a few places, and it's a very powerful focused radiation that can go pretty deep into the body and hit a target. It's not used a lot because the equipment itself is incredibly expensive and requires a huge outlay of space just to house it. I think that some of the facilities cost $20 million or so just to put a proton beam therapy unit in. And there are now other ways of getting sort of focused treatments without using proton beam.
We're running out of time. I just want to make sure I understand. There are certain of these radiological methods that are easier, less expensive, but also don't necessarily come up with the best results. So we start with a mammogram, and then we may go to an MRI or
correct.
A sonogram and go up to a CAT scan and from a CAT to a PET. And so some are more complete than others, but we try to start with the least invasive.
Well, except
that we've run out of time. And I want to thank you both, Dr. Zimmerman. Dr. Zimmerman, Dr. Sussman,
thanks
thank
for letting
you
us
so
come
much.
Out of the shadows.
On Monday's show, two very different takes on whether or not the Democrats can woo back the South. Then a Turkish author who's been very much in the news, Elif Shafak, and her latest novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. Plus a look at the emotional relationship many women have with money. And then the complex and often misunderstood borderline personality disorder, which affects roughly 10 million Americans. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, Samantha Morgan-Stern, and Tess Hartman. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.